March 28, 1995, Howard Braun and Selma Weiss are interviewing Leigh Kessler. This is National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Would you please tell us your name?
Leigh Kessler. This is Leigh Kessler dictating, and this is tape number 7, March 28th. The last we met, we were talking about my experiences in Texas. They were short-lived, and I was just beginning to tell why. But one, particularly young people, are not often aware of the feelings of their partners, their wives or their husbands, about certain matters, and tend to take their job situation for granted. What I was not aware of at the time was that my wife, a New Yorker, Brooklyn by birth, Manhattanite by upbringing, was now thrust into this new environment in Dallas, Texas, alone most of the day in a motel while I was at work at the hospital. I was experiencing the issues that I mentioned before, but was not truly aware of the problems that she faced. We tried to integrate to some extent in the community, and there was a Jewish community, but surprisingly, in my short stay there, I had little or no entree or exposure to it. Because of our interest in cultural issues, and because Dallas had been advertised throughout the post-war era, that is in the late 40s and 50s, as the city of the future, with much space taken up in the New York Times, particularly the New York Times Magazine section, there was frequent writing about the orchestra, the theater, social life, and so forth. My wife and I tried to participate in that. We found that the Dallas Symphony was a total bust. The hall was bad. The orchestra was second rate. The conductor, who we later knew in later years, was an alcoholic. The theater was open only 3 months per year, even though they never bothered to say that in any of the advertisements about Go West, young man. And the director of the theater, I think it was called the Guthrie Theater, if I'm not mistaken, may still be, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. But as a matter of fact, he was never there, and it was all sham. Everything we ran into, on the cultural level at least, was sham. People were very nice. Texans were very, very cordial people, well-mannered. But the number of things that we missed were included this lack of cultural depth. We had no direct entree to the Jewish community, at least at this point. We were somewhat appalled by the absence of trees. Surprisingly, one can never realize how important it is to come from a land that has trees in abundance and suddenly find themselves in an area where a tree in front of a house added at that time, in those years, those values, added $1,000 to $2,000 to the value of the house. Now, I'm talking about a house worth $20,000 or $30,000, so it's significant change in the price of the house depending on whether there was a small tree in front. So this was somewhat of a disappointment to us. But I must talk about the most important, and that is the social values of that time. In walking into the hospital, which had offered me a position, called Parkland Hospital, and I'll say a little more about Parkland Hospital. There was one entrance. Above the door, a sign read, "For Blacks Only." And another entrance above the door, it said, "For Whites Only." I went through the door that said, "For Whites Only," and I realized what I was doing. I was complying with an old custom that supported segregation. And the question was, in my mind, immediately, was I willing to lay down my life in opposition to this? In other words, sacrifice referrals, sacrifice good standing at the hospital. I realized at that time that these were possibilities. This was, remember, very early in the revolution in this country, the Black Revolution.
What year?
That was 19... let's see. Stop that. Yes, this was 1959. This was before the famous 60s, where there was general revolution, where there were bus sit-ins and so forth. Interestingly, it was also, Parkland Hospital was also the hospital to which John F. Kennedy was taken when he was murdered in Dallas. And this was just a couple of years later that that happened. Had I stayed there at Parkland Hospital and in Dallas, as I had been asked to do and invited to do, part of my assignment was the emergency room of Parkland Hospital. That was offered to me as a perk. And had I been there, I would have been the doctor who received John F. Kennedy. So it's interesting. As a matter of fact, the day that Kennedy was murdered, I was here in Pittsburgh, and I was operating at Westmoreland Hospital in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, and I came out of the operating room, was told by the nurses. I immediately called the gentleman who had invited me to Dallas and asked him, his name is Kim Clark, and asked him what had happened. He gave me the first-hand report of John F. Kennedy's murder. But at any rate, this issue about the black and white was uppermost in my mind. I came home, therefore, one night after working at the hospital, after the experiences that I mentioned with the students, with the country club, and with the black-white situation, and I looked at my dear wife, who was somewhat down and depressed, and it was obvious to me that we could not stay in Dallas under those circumstances. I picked up the telephone, I called Montefiore Hospital, the chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at Montefiore Hospital in New York, and I said, is that job offer still open? And he said, yes. I said, I'm leaving Dallas and we'll be there in a week. And that's how we terminated, and I just excused myself in Dallas, tried to explain, though I'm not sure that anybody really understood why I was leaving, but nonetheless, we got it packed up, got in our car, and moved back to New York City. When we arrived in New York, we went to Montefiore Hospital. We found an apartment. We lived in the Bronx of New York, and I began to work at Montefiore Hospital. The chief was a young man who had finished his training just 4 or 5 years before me. His name Charles Carton, C-A-R-T-O-N, and he was an extremely bright, very good neurosurgeon, also trained at the Neurological Institute, and he had been the one who had been urging me to come into association with him to do both clinical practice, teaching, and research. He was then very interested in the subjects of blood vessel surgery, blood vessels to the brain, and it was through him that I got interested in this, and we started out by doing what we now refer to as small blood vessel surgery. This was the beginning of my research experience at Montefiore, and I didn't have much of a clinical practice. We did have an affiliation with Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein was a new medical college that had been started just a couple of years before this. It was really an offshoot of the Yeshiva College of New York. And it was the first Jewish medical school. It was an important change in direction because, as I mentioned much earlier in these discussions, we were still laboring in medicine under a numerous classes. Mm-hmm. This is the first medical school that picks students on the basis of their grades and not on the basis of their religion, and was a very important contribution to the American scene. Albert Einstein was medical college was also promoted by the well-known and extremely important neurosurgeon by the name of Leo Davidoff, and I mentioned him previously. Leo Davidoff became the dean of Albert Einstein Medical College, but remained as the active consultant to Montefiore Hospital, which was a critical part of Albert Einstein Medical College. So my appointment to the staff of Montefiore Hospital in New York included an appointment to the teaching staff of Albert Einstein.
Did that take only Jewish students?
Wow. It turned out pretty much that way. That was not purposeful, but it was by predominance of application and predominance of grade point averages, it turned out that way. But there was no numerous classes by any means in Albert Einstein. The residency program, which had been started many years previous under Davidoff, continued at Albert Einstein and at Montefiore, and I became a part of that teaching program. But our main thrust at that time, from the point of view of development, was the study of blood vessel disease to the brain, sometimes referred to as strokes. And one particular stroke that was then prominently discussed was called TIAs, or transient ischemic attacks. And this is when a patient becomes momentarily paralyzed on one side and then gradually improves over a period of time. That time could be from a few minutes to a few hours, and if that is the case, then it's considered a transient attack. It was at that time realized that some of these attacks were due to blockage of the blood vessels of the neck, not blood vessels of the brain. And the group that I now became affiliated with, consisting of Charles Carton, the neurosurgeon, Elliot Hurwit, H-U-R-W-I-T-T, a vascular surgeon, and incidentally, vascular surgery was a fairly new specialty at that time, and myself, and one other person who was a vascular surgeon by the name of Bernard Seidenberg, we began to do animal experimentations on how to close a blood vessel, particularly a very small blood vessel, with the idea that we would be able to do this in the brain. This was some of the earliest work done in this field under our four names. We also began to open up blood vessels going to the brain from the heart and in the neck. And as a matter of fact, the first such operation ever done was done at Montefiore Hospital in 1953 by a neurosurgeon who really did nothing in the way of contribution to research or experimentation, but simply out of practical empiricism, did this on a patient and it was successful, namely opened up a blood vessel in the neck and cleaned out the atherosclerotic plaques. His name was Ken Strully, S-T-R-U-L-L-Y. This began to catch on like wildfire around the country, and from this point on, a debate ensued between non-surgical and surgical neurologists and neurosurgeons as to whether or not treatment was better by medicine or by surgery. Of course, I took the surgical side. This became an important thrust of mine, and we began to do a lot of surgery on blood vessels, but at the same time, on animals, began to experiment on how best we could do this in very small blood vessels. I'm talking about blood vessels measuring 4, 3, even 2 millimeters in.
You're pretty technical here.
Yeah, in depth. This required the use of a microscope, and it was just at that time that Zeiss from Germany came to this country with a microscope that they were selling for the purpose of operating experimentally. And we bought the first one sold in New York City. Microscopic surgery has become now a major aspect of the practice of neurosurgery, in fact, all surgery.
That was East Germany, wasn't it?
Yeah. The Zeiss company, the microscope that we bought, we used in the laboratory until one day my associate and I took the microscope into the operating room and actually did a small blood vessel operation in a brain with the microscope. And that was in 1960, and that was the first that I was ever aware that this was done. This became, in the next few years, the general practical way to operate in certain small blood vessel situations. So I was very much involved in the bottom of this, the very beginning of it. When I then finally returned to Pittsburgh to begin practice 2 years later, I had grants of a couple $100,000 to continue experimentation on circulation of the brain. And there was none of this work then being done in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh was considered pretty backward from a medical surgical point of view at that time. However, political situation in Montefiore Hospital in New York,
this was years,
was 1960, mm-hmm. 59, 60, 61, was very tumultuous. There was a lot of animosity between the dean, Leo Davidoff, and my chief, Charles Carton. And Charles Carton picked up and left and went to California. And I was left sort of like a limb without any leaves on it. And I was young and inexperienced and somewhat exposed to the wrath of Davidoff, who was not willing to accept me on the basis of the fact that I was first trained at the Neurological Institute, which he hated. And I told you in another tape why he hated it. And he never got over that, never realizing that any change had really taken place. And the other reason was that he didn't invite me to come to Montefiore, but Charlie Carton did. And when Charlie Carton left, he felt that it was only right that I should leave too. So I decided to come to my hometown of Pittsburgh and not stay and fight all these political forces that were arrayed against me. And it was a situation where if you weren't in Davidoff's favor, you could not go anywhere in the medical school, as he was the dean and the all-powerful medical person, and there was another man who was allied with him who was also world famous by the name of Zimmerman, who was a pathologist, and they were so opposed to any teachings of the Neurological Institute, and I think this is important sociologic information, that there was a Friday morning conference at Montefiore to which Charles Carton and I were always present, And if not I, but at least Charles Carton, certainly a brilliant man, ever spoke, nothing we ever said, I forgot to say, Davidoff then wrote a book in which he had recorded all the discussions that took place, and they were called Davidoff's Friday Morning Conferences, and it came out in the form of a book. And though our names were listed in the front of the book as participating in the conferences, we were never once quoted
or credited
with any comments in the book. And as a matter of fact, when I was at Neurological Institute and Carton, we were learning a new type of brain surgery having to do with dealing with abnormal blood vessels. This was a new type of surgery based on a number of things: improvement in anesthesia, the use of the microscope, better knowledge of how to protect the patient while the procedure was taking place. But nonetheless, this was new development. This was late 50s, early 60s development, the eradication of abnormal blood vessels called arteriovenous malformations. When I first spoke of this, when such a case was presented at Montefiore Hospital under Davidoff and Zimmerman, they actually laughed at me when I said that AV malformation could be excised and the patient could be fine. This is a man who had done more neurosurgery to that date than any man other than Harvey Cushing, and Zimmerman certainly was a world-renowned pathologist. So this was a state that I was faced with, and it did not look very promising. We decided to leave and come back to Montefiore in Pittsburgh, where I knew that I always had, expected to have a reasonably welcome reception. That was in 1961, the summer of 1961. We then came back, bought a house in Pittsburgh. My mother,
house where?
In Churchill. My mother was living here. She was then married to Elmer Hamburg, and Elmer's son, Lester Hamburg, was 4 or 5 years older than I, and he made the necessary arrangements. He was then, Elmer was then vice president of the board of the hospital, and the necessary arrangements were made. I was then surprised to find that when I returned to Pittsburgh, I was not received with the same warmth that I had expected. The man with whom I had been closest was Yale David Koskoff, who I have spoken of before, who I thought was a very competent neurosurgeon, and I found that he was very hostile to my return. I was a threat. I was too naive to realize that. In fact, jumping a little ahead, when I got my first operation and I came in to operate at Montefiore Hospital, first patient referred for surgery, I was told by the head nurse in the operating room that I couldn't use the instruments because they were David Koskoff's instruments and had been bought out of research funds that was under the jurisdiction of David Koskoff. This created a tempest in a teapot, and after some arguing and so forth and calls to the front office, I was told that I could use them temporarily, that I would have to get my own instruments. It just so happened that the president of the board then was Stanley Kahn, who was a friend of my mother's husband, and Stanley Kahn, as president of the hospital, out of a president's fund, simply bought instruments for me. So it pays, as one can see, to be well situated and connected in order to get anywhere, even after all those years of training. And by the way, I brought with me about $200,000 in grants for experimental purposes, for establishing an experimental laboratory.
Okay, you put it back. You put it back.
Okay. I then set about doing a number of things that were necessary. Number one, I had to find an office. Number two, I had to find a source of referral of patients. Number three, I had to set up my research laboratory. And number four, I had to buy and establish a home, all within a very short period of time. The latter was, of course, primary, and as I mentioned, we had come to Pittsburgh, and through my stepbrother, Lester Hamburg, we were able to find a home in Churchill, in a little new development called Sherwood Forest. And I wanted to be somewhat in the country at that time. I did not want to be in the city. I'm not sure. Obviously, I did not make the right choice because we didn't stay there too long for various reasons. But I also did it for the reason that one of my plans in developing a practice in neurosurgery, which, by the way, is not simple unless you go into partnership with somebody with an already established practice, it was necessary to find hospitals that were willing to refer patients, that is, the hospital doctors of a given hospital, who were willing to refer patients to me at Montefiore Hospital. It was my plan to do the work at Montefiore, but to go in consultation to whatever hospital could find use of me. The only place that I could find at that time that was not under the jurisdiction of some already established neurosurgeon, of which there were 10 in the greater Pittsburgh area, as compared to about 50 today, I was able to get an appointment at Greensburg, Jeannette, Latrobe, and Northfield Passman Hospital, all of which were quite a trip, automobile trip. So I set up my schedule, and then, of course, I opened an office in Pittsburgh. The nice thing about this whole process was that we had a famous old general surgeon in Pittsburgh. I thought he was old at that time. He probably wasn't as old then as I think he was. But he was one of the old-timers, and I've mentioned his name, Tom Shoup. And Tom Shoup was then being assisted by a friend, a social friend of mine, who was a general surgeon and a man just 4 or 5 years older than I, by the name of Sidney Kaufman. Sidney Kaufman became Tom Shoup's right-hand man, handled all of his patients, assisted him at surgery, did the openings and closings, plus handled his own practice out of an office at 3600 Ford Street. When I arrived in Pittsburgh, Tom Shoup, who had hardly spoken many words to me or to anybody in my entire internship and residency training program in Pittsburgh, said to Sidney Kaufman, offer him an office free of charge for 1 year. So that I moved into the office with these two gentlemen, paid no rent for the first year, and established myself in the hospitals that I mentioned, and made routine rounds of those hospitals on a regular basis to see their consultations, with the idea that these patients would then be referred to Montefiore Hospital.
Okay, why don't we stop there, because that's on this.
I was able to find people to set up my laboratory. I was able to find laboratory space in an old building that we had on Darrow Street, at the top of Darrow Street, behind the then Montefiore parking lot. And I was able to find two people, a mathematician and an animal man, somebody who was trained in animal management, to handle my experiments, and I set up a laboratory to do radioactive cerebral blood flow study laboratory. So that everything was going along very well, except there was one serious lack, and that was my inability to obtain an appointment at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Now, this was an issue about which there had been much said earlier, Montefiore's relationship with the university. But when I asked for an appointment, the then chief of neurosurgery, who was a very nice man, was Stuart Rao. And Stuart Rao explained to me that there was no way that I could have an appointment, that even if he took a person in to his own practice at that time, that they were not likely to agree to give him an appointment. And it's interesting how covetous the University of Pittsburgh has been of these so-called appointments, which were in a sense meaningless because they didn't pay anything and they didn't provide one with any paper.